Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The U.S. and its NATO allies claim they are continuing to send massive military aid to Ukraine. At the same time, Washington appears to have no interest in a negotiated end to the conflict. This begs the question, what is Washington's policy goal? Could it be direct conflict with Russia? Crosstalking the Ukraine conflict, I'm joined by my guest, John Varoli, in New York. He is a political analyst as well as a former foreign correspondent in Russia. In Lake Jackson, we have Daniel McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And in London, we have Marco Gasic. He is an international affairs commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Daniel, let me go to you first in Lake Jackson. My question in my introduction is very, very simple. What is Washington's goals in this conflict here? Because this massive sending of arms to Ukraine, which nobody knows where it goes to, who's the end user, if it's going to be sold on the black market. One of the problems with Western coverage of this conflict is that Ukraine is notorious for its corruption. I mean, it makes corruption in Russia blush. I can guarantee you that. So what is Washington's goals here? Because it seems to me that they're calling the shots, not Mr. Zelensky. Go ahead, Daniel.
It seems to me this is the most incompetent handling of a major foreign affairs issue in the history of the world. I don't believe that Washington has a clue what it's doing. The only thing that's driving the policy right now is the military-industrial complex. Every week now, for the last at least two or three weeks, we see a new $800 million military aid package going to Ukraine. You know, after a while, these $800 million weekly checks are going to start adding up, right? So you have the U.S. sending massive amounts of military. Last week, the president's people met with the top U.S. military manufacturer saying, hey, guys, we got to ramp up production. They said, great. The CEO of Raytheon has been open about what a massive profit this is turning out to be for his shareholders. You're seeing a policy driven not by U.S. national interest, but by the special interests of the military-industrial complex and the special interests of people like Victoria Nuland, who, let's not forget, is Ukrainian, and she's got a beef with the country of her origin, and she's fighting it out on the world battlefield, and the rest of us are having to pay the price for it.
Yeah, and John, I don't see how the Ukrainians benefit from all of this, but I suppose I'm being too picky. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, Ukraine is just a protectorate of the United States, of the NATO empire, and it's just a tool to strike at Russia. And I agree with what Daniel said, but I would like to add, let's not forget the ideological component here. Moscow, Russia, as a country that openly says it protects traditional values, it is the arch enemy of the globalist liberal order. So there is that very important ideological component here. And they want to destroy Vladimir Putin's rule, and they would like to destroy Russia. So this is really, I don't want to say it's not yet a total war, because a total war would mean direct confrontation between NATO and Russia, but it's just short of a total war. And the goal of NATO is to destroy Russia. I've spoken to people at the Atlantic Council, and they really believe that they're going to win. They're going to destroy Russia, and it's going to break up into different regions and countries, new countries, that then they will be able to control and exploit.
Yeah, Marco, I seem to remember the recently departed Madeleine Albright asking, well, why should Russia have Siberia? Echoing what John just said there. John, just before you go to Marco, I agree with you. It's a civilizational war, okay? I think that that's a component most people don't understand. Because they're ideologically obsessed and blinded, I would say. You know, Marco, you know, you hear this theme. I'm just completely bewildered by it. The Ukrainians are winning. The Ukrainians are winning. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. And it seems to me that the people like Victoria Nuland are willing to fight Russia indirectly to the last Ukrainian. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. Go ahead, Marco, in London.
They are. And the longer that battle goes on, the more Ukrainians will be eliminated from the planet. So it's a war, indeed, as you say, to the last Ukrainian, and indeed to the last amounts of Ukrainian currency available to return under the Lend-Lease Act, by which a lot of this aid, so-called, is appearing. Ukraine will have to pay for most of it with money it doesn't have, having been stolen in the 90s by its oligarchs and in the 2000s by the Western neoliberalization policies it was forced to follow. So this is really a war that is for Ukraine curtains in many ways, unless it reaches a negotiated deal soon. If it does, then it has a future. If it doesn't, it's only got a past and not much of one either.
Daniel, I also said in my introduction that do they want conflict with Russia? I mean, total out-and-out conflict, because it's very much in the cards because, you know, you hear this, you know, this Article 5, okay? Well, it's not so simple, because if NATO countries are sending arms to Ukraine, then they're a co-belligerent, and then doesn't that make them fair game in this conflict? We have to remember Ukraine is not a member of NATO. You know, Article 5 is not very clear here because Article 1 is not being applied to, meaning not getting involved in an offensive conflict here. I mean, again, the public is misled here, because at a certain point, the Russians are going to say, you're sending in weapons to kill our troops. I mean, we're going to stop that, okay? You've been warned. Go ahead, Daniel.
And that's literally the case in any conflict anywhere in history. It's always been the case. If you are arming the person, the country that's killing our people, you are at war with us. The thing that's most disturbing about this, Peter, is that to this point, Vladimir Putin, for better or for worse, has done everything he said he would do. He's made good on every promise, every threat, everything that he said. Last week, the Russian government warned the U.S. They sent an official diplomatic letter saying, stop sending weapons to Ukraine. And the U.S., as it did in December, when the Russians proposed a new security architecture for Europe, again, they laughed Russia off the stage. And so there's a huge danger with U.S. officials, again, refusing to listen to anything the President Putin has said, to discount it, because that is sleepwalking us into a direct conflict. I don't know what it is that's keeping Russia from bombing, for example, maybe a staging ground in Poland or in the Czech Republic, because as you say, these weapons are being used to kill Russians, and there's under the laws of war justification for stopping it. I don't know how far it will go. I don't know how far Putin's patience will be on this.
You know, Marco, I on a number of media venues, I said before the conflict started, is that it's very simple when you're looking at what the Kremlin has to say. They don't bluff. They act. And Daniel just gave us the background to that. In December and in January, all through February, the Russians are saying, we're not kidding. We, you know, we've sent you some proposals. You don't seem to take them seriously. But we are serious, and we will take measures. And you know what? They did. So the fact that they're shrugging this off now is just idiocy. Go ahead, Marco.
Well, they may be in a world of their own audience, really, because to go back to the previous point about the message that Ukraine is winning or with the Western aid, I mean, there are about 150 PR companies directed from Washington and London and liaising with Kiev, feeding them the script, the victory script, the mantra to keep everyone motivated. So that's what, in a way, they're listening to themselves, and they've managed to ban RT and all alternative voices pretty much from the Western airwaves. So it's not surprising in a way that they believe their own message, which they constantly repeat. But obviously the reality is that Russia is indeed winning and will indeed dictate the terms of a solution if it's not negotiated. So I would encourage the Ukrainians to stop reading the Western mainstream media or watching it, and to start actually negotiating in all seriousness to reach a peace that that everyone can actually agree on, and which will end the violence and the bloodshed, which is of which the Ukrainians are now the main casualties.
You know, John, one of the things, this media blackout and throttling, RT is a very good example here, is that the Western media doesn't really want to talk about the nature of the regime in Kyiv, the political forces that are in play, the number, you know, obviously, I've said it many times on this program, but most people don't know that almost all of media has been nationalized in Ukraine. Political opposition has been outlawed. These things don't make it through because we're fighting for Ukraine's democracy. Well, it's not. And you know what? They had a democracy. It was overthrown in 2014. Again, that doesn't seem to seep through. You know, this is an amazing, over-the-top propaganda program that the likes we've never seen. I mean, this, you know, 2003 in Iraq, this pales in comparison. Go ahead, John.
I understand why you're so startled, and we all are, but it's finally time for us to say that this is all obviously very deliberate, because it's a deliberate policy of waging war against Russia. They do not care about the truth. They do not care. When I say they, the establishment in the Western countries, in the NATO countries, they do not care about truth. They do not care about freedom and democracy and human rights. They just have one goal: destroy Russia at any cost. We just have to, again, I understand why you're startled, and I am too, but we have to stop being startled. You have to understand what their goal is.
Daniel, the aim is to destroy Russia at any cost, even if it impacts their own citizenry in the West, because that's quite obvious right now. Daniel.
Well, Putin's price hike, you know, I just wonder, every time I go to fill up my car, every time I go to the store, I see Putin's price hike. You know, Americans are not very patient with things like this. And the president said there are two reasons why you're paying more, COVID and Putin. I just wonder how long they will be patient with this mantra as it starts to hit home. You know, all of the wars that America has engaged in the past 30 years, they've never impacted Americans directly.
Right.
They've all
right.
been hidden in the Fed printing money out of thin air. Americans haven't had to pay. This is the first time they're actually having to pay up front in an indirect but relatively direct way. So we'll see how long they'll be patient for this. The problem in the United States is we don't have an opposition party. We have two pro-war parties.
That's right.
Republicans are running on being more pro-war than the Democrats. So there is no alternative right now in the United States. We're a single-party state.
Well, you know, it's interesting as the 2022 elections come up, there was an empty lane. And of course, never count on the Republicans to do the right thing. Never count on them. They'll always let you down. OK, and because public opinion is against this. OK, but of course, the Republican leadership is tone deaf. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Ukraine conflict. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing the Ukraine conflict. Okay, let's go back to Marco in London. Marco, a few years ago, before he passed, Stephen Cohen was on this program. It was such a pleasure to have him on. John Mearsheimer was also on. And he was talking about the possibility of a World War III, a nuclear conflict, NATO against Russia. And I kind of pushed back gently against it. And he said, Peter, I am very, very serious. We're on that path. Prescient at that. Do you think one of the things that really bothers me, I mean, I remember the anti-war movement in the 1980s, you know, intermediate missiles, all that. I remember that very well, okay? And it seems to me, look at the rhetoric, the very reckless rhetoric that comes out of the political class, particularly in the United States and the UK. They're both the worst. The UK is the worst of the worst, actually. They seem to have forgotten the terror that we had in the 1980s of a nuclear war. You remember, like, Threads and the Day After and all that? I mean, we were terrified. They don't seem to care. They seem to be immune to it. I mean, we even have members of Congress saying, everything's on the table, everything. You know, I mean, this Rambo-type rhetoric is just, you know, it's very dangerous. So, Marco, what happened to the public?
It really is very strange. The public effectively has disappeared from the discourse. But I really reel with astonishment when I hear some pronouncements from UK politicians as well, airily talking about imposing no-fly zones on Putin over Ukraine and so on. It is astonishing to me that they could, in all seriousness, be talking about this. I mean, we have already, for example, the Kievan regime doesn't distinguish between a big war for itself and a big war for the world. And it seems to imagine that if it gets NATO involved in a war against the Russian Federation, that that's going to be a good outcome, which you can understand because they all seem to be a little bit deluded in Kiev. However, to see UK and Western politicians and indeed US politicians joining in is worrying indeed, because Russia recognizes that in its conflict potentially with NATO, it would face a world war. Ukraine seems to be keen on a world war. And if we have a third party happy to have one, or indeed a rogue element somewhere down the command structure who might decide unilaterally to take some act that might have consequences, we are all risking world war, and the population is docile in the West, fed on a diet of it's all okay and we're being beastly to Putin and that's all as it should be, and we'll have cold showers to pay for it. That seems to be the Western game plan, not a good one.
I think if Stanley Kubrick were alive, he could make a sequel to Dr. Strangelove right now. I really do, okay? Because we have the same cast of characters here. You know, John, one of the interesting... Russia is losing. Well, I mean, I've talked to serious military people. There aren't any serious military people in the West because they haven't won any wars, okay? They just excuse themselves and they just get huge amounts of money sent their way to lose, okay? In wars they never should have fought. But talking to military personnel here is that Russia has really actually committed a very little of its armed forces for the reason why we're making this program, because they do plan on that NATO may start something and they're prepared for it, okay? That's why they haven't had this overwhelming force. They're keeping almost everything in reserve because they know the thinking or the lack of thinking in NATO capitals. John, go ahead.
Yeah, well, as far as NATO capitals, let's remember, so Johnson, basically a comedian, Biden, a senile old man, of course, Yelensky, a comedian as well, Trudeau, a fop, a joke. So we have these Western leaders in power who really are just not capable. They're not able. They should not be in those positions of power, but yet they are, which brings me to the conclusion that there is a power behind them. And you can deride me as a conspiracy theorist, please, I don't care. But I think there is a power behind these people. And the goal, and I know this is gonna sound radical, but I think their goal is World War III, and maybe even nuclear war. Maybe we have to start entertaining the idea that maybe somehow a new Nazi party has arisen in the West. It's not announcing itself overtly, of course. Maybe these people are the grandchildren, great-grandchildren of the original Nazis, or maybe they're just inspired by Nazi ideology, but we can see what they're doing. We can see who they are by the results of what they're doing in Ukraine. They are psychotic mass murderers. That is what is happening in Ukraine. They knew what was going to happen. You poke the Russian bear for 8 years, and you think it's not going to react? No, I'm sorry. Do not blame Vladimir Putin for what's happening in Ukraine. I put all the blame on NATO, on Western leaders.
Yes, you know,
so maybe.
Go ahead, Marco,
maybe,
jump in.
I was going to say, maybe it depends on what we mean by winning. Washington will feel that certainly in the short term, it's won a massive victory. It's got Europe in its pocket, a supplicant, dependent in the future on energy supplies and resources and political orientation on Washington entirely. There's a new iron curtain between Europe and the Russian part of Europe. In a way, America has got everything it wanted in terms of European compliance. Nord Stream 2 is parked completely, at least for the moment. So in the short term, the Americans may feel very pleased with what they've got. They've got an outlet for their arms sales in a huge amount now. And we should remember that NATO is, at the end of the day, just a vehicle for arms sales by the US to member countries. That's its main function, apart from obeying orders from the Pentagon. So Washington should feel, or does feel, I would have thought, pleased at the moment. But what it doesn't factor in is what it's risking. It's already lost most of the rest of the world, which
That's
is
right.
not joining in the anti-Russia campaign. And it's also in danger of losing Europe once winter sets in, once industries in Germany become uncompetitive because they're paying sky-high prices for the energy they need to make their products. Once the thing hits the fan, then you'll have a different Europe and a different European attitude. So Washington is in danger of losing it all. So if I were in Washington, I'd start thinking more long-term and trying to plan for a negotiated solution, however unpleasant that might seem to the hawks.
Daniel, I wish that could happen, but I just simply don't. I mean, that's the rational path, because just a kind of an extension of what we just heard from John and Marco is that, you know, Europe is flexing its really weak muscles, you know, and it feels really good about itself, but it's isolating itself from the rest of the world. The Chinese are watching, the Russians obvious are. These are not reliable people. These are not people that you can actually seriously deal with. You know, what happened between December and the time of the military incursion is that the Russians remember this very carefully. You can't talk to these people. These people don't tell the truth. They have a different agenda all the time. And I personally think the Peter the Great's great outreach to the West is over. It's done, okay? Because you can't trust these people. Daniel, go ahead.
Well, I kind of expected Putin to give up this morning because, you know, Janet Yellen walked out of the G20 meeting when the Russians started speaking. And I can just imagine, Mr. President, you'll never guess what happened. We've got to give up. Janet Yellen walked out of our meeting. We're so depressed. But, you know, Peter, more seriously, I spent over a decade working in the Washington foreign policy establishment. And the one thing that I found most astonishing is the absolute absence of intellectual curiosity among foreign policy practitioners. I mean, this is an absolute bubble in D.C. They read a couple of newspapers. They only speak to each other. They don't have any dealings with anyone who has different kinds of views. They never certainly wanted to talk to me because I read things that weren't approved. You know, I didn't only read the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And so you have a group of people who live in a bubble who talk only to each other in the same language. They basically are spending the entire lives getting high on their own supply. And that's why one of the reasons I think you have such a crappy U.S. foreign policy.
You know, John, you know, it's very interesting because this elite mentality, and it comes from virtue signaling, you know, something must be done. Well, I mean, it's so easy to say that, okay? But the consequences of that, we've seen that repeatedly. Syria, Libya, everything was going well in Afghanistan until it wasn't going well. I mean, there's no learning curve here whatsoever. And as it's been pointed out in the program already, is that policies that are being made in London and Washington and Brussels are affecting Western citizens now. Energy, food. I mean, this is something, the first time in my lifetime that this has happened. And I have to believe that's going to create instability. That's where you're going to see the apple cart turn over. And it's not going to be pretty. John.
Yeah. Yes, that's possible. I mean, I guess your question is, will there be some mass discontent and riots? And I mean, it certainly is possible, but the amount of social control here is tremendous and growing every day. And they're starting to implement something that resembles it. Social credit system, and a lot of Americans are indebted, and they're on the hook, as you would say. There's a lot of ways to exert control over the American people, over the European people, and of course, the mass media is the greatest tool of social control in the U.S. because there's so much pressure to conform. I can't even say in public that I once used to live in Russia. If I would say that I simply lived in Russia, I don't have to even voice any support for Russia. The fact that I lived in Russia is compromising, is enough to get me in a lot of trouble here today. So I just say I lived in Eastern Europe. I have to hide that fact. So it's, let's remember the mass media is a tremendous tool in the government's ability to control the population in Europe and in the USA.
You know, Marco, I'm glad that John said that. I've lived in Russia for about 24 years. And even with this going on now, NATO, people have watched NATO's aggression. As an American living here in Russia, I have no animosity directed to me whatsoever. Zero. I'm a foreigner. I wear a funny bow tie. And people are friendly to me. They want to, actually overly friendly. And I always feel this really sad that when I have my Russian friends from RT that would go to Washington or London, and they were treated in a very shabby way. And I just thought, it's really interesting, isn't it? One side hates, and the other one simply won't. Go ahead, Marco.
I think traditionally, Russian and East European audiences have had a kind of admiration for America. It's that kind of cultural imperialism thing. But it's there was a lot of a liking in principle for the ideas represented by the UK and the US. And it's not endemic in the psyche or indeed in the educational system of the Russians to really pour scorn and this vitriol on the other, which the supposedly pro-diversity system of the UK and the US is so keen on doing. I mean, there is this utter, the name Russian, the brand name is accompanied by hatred pretty much. And it's full on now because the Russians have chosen to exercise their use of force without waiting for the Americans to approve of it, which is what the Americans have been doing all over the world for no good reason whatsoever. The Russians have done it for a very good reason.
On that point there, gentlemen, we have run out of time. Fascinating discussion here. I want to thank my guests in New York, London, and in Lake Jackson, and thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.